Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the Pandora Papers. With me to discuss the Pandora Papers and the broader problem of global corruption is Miles Kaler. Miles is Senior Fellow for Global Governance at the Council. He is also Distinguished Professor at American University School of International Service. He holds that latter title because he has written widely and well on a range of topics on international politics and international political economy. He also happens to be one of the smartest and nicest people I know. So, Miles, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Jim. Glad to be here.
Okay, Miles, I pick up the paper last week, and I see we have breaking news about the Pandora Papers. For people who didn't have a chance to sort of delve in beyond the headlines, what exactly are the Pandora Papers?
Well, the Pandora Papers are the most recent in a actually fairly long series of large-scale document leaks. The Panama Papers 2016, Paradise Papers 2017. The Pandora Papers is a slightly larger set of document leaks, more than twice as many offshore account holders apparently as the Panama Papers. And basically, they reveal the use of an offshore system, financial system, largely secret. These are often called secrecy jurisdictions, these offshore jurisdictions, where political leaders, billionaires, and others are managing their wealth, and some would say, of course, hiding their wealth from public scrutiny and from legal action. This is information, obviously, that these account holders would not like to have public for various reasons, and it is now being poured over by people around the world, and of course, has been poured over by journalists and major media organizations in this country, the Washington Post, the BBC, the Guardian in Britain, and many, many others. I'd also note that these leaks typically come through the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ, very important group linked to other media organizations. And the role of the media in exposing these offshore accounts and their holders has been extremely important in all of these cases.
Okay, I want to dive into some of the details, Miles, but before we do that, could you just explain where this information is coming from? Who is doing the leaking? Do we know who is doing the leaking? Is it from one institution, more than one?
So far as I know, the ICIJ does not reveal that for obvious reasons. So but these documents concern a whole range of different types of companies, spreadsheets, emails, a whole range of different documents. So interesting question as to how they laid their hands on them. But as far as I know, we don't know that. And I don't think the ICIJ is interested in telling us that.
But presumably, since the documents come from over the span of several decades and seem to apply to or involve so many people, there's likely not one source for the information, correct?
Correct. That would be my assumption. Yes, that's right. This would be insiders, plural, probably, who are leaking these documents.
So then let's talk about the headlines from the Pandora Papers. Now, what's the sort of most important takeaways, at least from a first glance, at what we know about this big data dump?
Well, in some ways, it follows on from the previous ones, Panama Paradise. The offshore system, financial system, which has many legitimate uses as well as illicit uses, has not been a secret for a long time. But with each data dump, with each set of documents, we learn about more political leaders, more of the wealthiest in the world, who make use of these jurisdictions. In some cases, for legal reasons, as they will protest. In other cases, less certain about how they're being used. And of course, that's the big concern. Licit or legal, as well as illegal types of transactions take place in these offshore secrecy jurisdictions. And that's a great concern to political leaders and, of course, prosecutors and others who are trying to deal with money laundering and other crimes.
So maybe I should ask you this question, Miles. What exactly is the offshore system? Whose shore is it off of? Are we talking about a limited set of jurisdictions? Are we talking about Switzerland, Caribbean island nations? What is sort of the structure of this offshore system?
The critical aspect is secrecy and the willingness to grant secrecy of different kinds for different types of accounts and different types of transactions. In the industrialized world, Luxembourg, Switzerland used to have a reputation, Switzerland in particular, for bank secrecy. Because of pressure from other jurisdictions, a lot of that has been eroded in the case of Switzerland. But now we're talking about cases like the British Virgin Islands. That's a big player in this set of documents. Cayman Islands, and of course, one that got a lot of attention in the American press. These jurisdictions don't have to be offshore. We discovered that South Dakota has become a major trust company secrecy jurisdiction because of legislation by the South Dakota legislature. So you can create an incentive for individuals to conduct financial transactions nearly anywhere by managing your regulatory regime regime in a way that makes it attractive to them. And some governments, once again, these small Caribbean cases or the Isle of Jersey off of the UK, this is big business for them. They're small, very small economies. And this attraction to international finance and corporate service providers and the whole network of enablers is big business for them. And obviously, they would intend to keep it, I assume, going forward.
How exactly is it big business for these entities, whether they're small island jurisdictions like the Jersey Islands or the Cayman Islands or South Dakota? Is it simply the matter of the fees you get from registering these companies and maybe any taxes paid to those companies? Is it the money actually goes there and stays in South Dakota or in Switzerland? How does that work?
Well, it would vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I mean, the big beneficiaries are the network of enablers, as they could be called. That includes accountants, corporate service providers, lawyers, banks in some cases, financial services companies of all kinds. They set up shop, they conduct business here, and that obviously has positive spillover effects in these economies. In some cases, like South Dakota, it impresses me, and here I can't claim to be an expert on South Dakota politics, but it seems like the kind of trust company lobby is a lobby. It's not as if the South Dakota economy is benefiting an enormous amount from this. They have found a way to convince the legislature to change the legislation and regulatory rules in South Dakota in a way that makes it attractive for trust companies to set up shop there and conduct transactions of various kinds. So it's really the network probably that benefits and the spillover effects from that network as they operate in these jurisdictions that makes the biggest benefit for the jurisdictions themselves.
Miles, neither of us are lawyers, so I don't want to delve into the specific legal frameworks of these systems that make it attractive for people who have money, however it is gotten, to park it elsewhere. But could you just give us a general sense of what the characteristics would be of, let's say, the South Dakota law that would make it an attractive place to park money or to register ownership of something?
Well, in South Dakota and other jurisdictions, as I mentioned earlier, the primary characteristic that's attractive is secrecy.
Okay.
And also immunity from certain legal actions that could be taken. So you could set something up so that it would be very difficult, A, to just take a very private example, an ex-spouse to discover what your assets are or to take legal action to claim some of those assets. But it could be something much more public than that. Tax evasion, obviously, would be one possibility that is of great concern to the jurisdictions where this wealth is fleeing from. And other crimes could be concealed as well. One of the cases that came up in the Pandora Papers is an art dealer, Douglas Latchford, who apparently used these offshore jurisdictions to conceal art that had essentially been looted from Cambodia over time. At least that's the allegation. So there are various types of assets that can be shielded in various ways from both scrutiny, public scrutiny, which if you're a politician, like the former prime minister, now former prime minister of the Czech Republic, Mr. Babiš, or King Abdullah of Jordan, you just don't want anyone to know, even if it's technically strictly legal, as ex-prime minister Babiš has protested, you don't prefer the public to know that you have this much wealth or that it's being parked in offshore jurisdictions. So the secrecy is very important. Or you may be obviously trying to avoid taxes. You may be sheltering money that is associated with various crimes. And of course, this gets into the whole anti-money laundering criminal network that could be using these offshore jurisdictions, which has been of concern for decades.
I should note here, you mentioned how people might set up trusts to foil a spouse in a divorce proceeding. That Planet Money, which is a podcast put together by NPR, has done a number of episodes on this whole issue of tax havens and the like. And one in particular is episode 390. We set up an offshore company in a tax haven. And so people who are interested in the details of how this works can listen to that episode.
Yes.
It's actually surprisingly easy because these jurisdictions, in many cases, don't ask many questions and they allow you to set up ownership structures where no one knows who the actual owner is. I think that's a big issue here. Now, of course, Miles, I think an important point that you made is that there's a debate about whether or not people who are taking advantage of tax havens are acting legally or illegally, ethically or unethically. And I imagine if you got lawyers there, they could split hairs on some of these boundary cases. And as we look at it, it sort of plays into actual politics. I mean, ex-Prime Minister Babiš was prime minister up until the weekend when he was turned out by the Czech voters. Now, just narrowly, but I would suspect that this news certainly didn't help his chances of winning re-election.
Correct.
So let's sort of look first just in terms of the people who've been named. You mentioned Babiš. You mentioned Abdullah, the art dealer. Anybody else of significance politically caught up in this most recent release?
I don't recall too many other major political figures. It was also very interesting that none of our super well wealthy individuals in the United States were apparently named in the Pandora Papers. And at least one comment was that the tax rates for super wealthy individuals in the United States are already quite low. Therefore, there's no need to use offshore tax havens. But there were, I think, King Abdullah and Mr. Babbage were the primary major political figures that were named. And once again, they protested, certainly ex-Prime Minister Babbage protested, that this was not an illegal transaction, you know, that he had paid taxes, et cetera, et cetera. For political leaders, very often, it's the appearance that is the critical factor, as much as whether they have actually conducted any kind of corrupt activity. And depending on the political system, there would be a political cost to this. It's also important to note that sometimes political figures are brought down by corruption that is not linked to offshore havens. So at the same time that ex-Prime Minister Babbage was having his difficulties electorally, which we cannot attribute even primarily or even maybe in a subsidiary way to the Pandora Papers, the Chancellor of Austria, Sebastian Kurz, who is a rising superstar on the right in Europe, was brought down by corruption allegations, which had no connection at all to any kind of offshore activities, as we know. It was kind of homegrown domestic corruption. And it's important to note that a lot of corruption is homegrown and domestic and stays that way.
Yeah, just looking at the news, the only names I saw that really popped out besides the one you mentioned would be President Zelensky of Ukraine.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
I must say, as I tried to read the news stories, I was a bit lost as to exactly what it is that he had done. It's something to do with a production company he had previously owned. And I guess also the president of Kenya, Mr. Kenyatta, whose family was linked to a bunch of offshore entities. Though again, I'm not sure whether these fall in the illegal, unethical, or merely politically embarrassing camp.
I mean, there's an important difference to keep in mind between tax evasion and tax avoidance, as any lawyer you spoke to would tell
you. Okay, well then you probably should explain that.
Well, tax evasion is a crime. Okay, so that clearly is linked. It's what is called in the illicit financial flows literature, the predicate crime, which is why we would be interested in the illicit financial flows that are coming from it and why governments are interested in tracking it down. Tax avoidance, moving your money around different jurisdictions to reduce your tax exposure, is not technically a crime, though many would argue it's unethical and certainly unfair and has become a big political issue, not just for individuals, but for corporations. So that is now subject of negotiation at the OECD. We just announced a new agreement at the OECD, at least the first stages of an agreement at the OECD, to set a minimum global tax rate. That's dealing with the issue of tax avoidance, primarily by corporations. But individuals also try to do tax avoidance as well. I mean, simple features in the United States, individuals move to states in the United States that don't have an income tax. Nothing illegal about that. People try to reduce their tax exposure. So trying to separate all of this out is very, very complicated. And it requires a great deal of investigation on the part of not only the journals who reveal this, obviously coming up will be lawyers, prosecutors, and others who will be poring over some of this data to see if there's anything there that is of interest to them. I mean, the main problem, Jim, is basically a lot of money sloshes around the world all the time, every day, every second, and it all looks the same in many ways. And determining what is illicit, what is dirty money, and what is not is very, very difficult. It's just that some jurisdictions, as you have already mentioned, don't ask a lot of questions. And that becomes a critical part of the effort to deal with this problem, which is know your customer, KYC, which banks in this country are supposed to do, banks in Europe and other parts of the world are supposed to do. But in many cases, the number of questions asked are not such that you really know your customer.
Well, I think it's often hard for governments to get this information, partly because certainly in governments that have rule of law, you have to deal with lawyers. And if you have a lot of money, you can hire very good lawyers who can bury you under a lot of paperwork. And then you get into these arguments over what's legal or illegal and what's a legitimate interpretation of an arcane provision in the tax code. I will note, just looking at the IRS, Donald Trump is not the only person who's had an audit or a contested filing with the IRS that's lasted a long time, because these are inherently very complicated issues.
You're right. One of the advantages, of course, of having a lot of money parked offshore is that they can hire an army of lawyers, as you said, which makes it very difficult for governments that are, for example, trying to recuperate money that has been stolen, essentially, or looted from their governments and their countries by kleptocrats, are often stymied by this. And who is going to take that legal action? For example, in the case of the Marcos family, in the Philippines or some other cases, you have to have a regime change for the government in the country in question, which is most concerned, to take that legal action. And if they don't take that legal action, the U.S. Department of Justice has taken action in some of these cases, and other financial authorities in other countries have taken it as well. But what's their incentive to try to recuperate assets for another country because of corruption that takes place in another country? So how many limited resources do you want to devote to that? Even though it has great global benefits, it is a real issue.
Well, let's talk about this broader global issue of corruption. You noted earlier, Miles, that countries like Luxembourg and Switzerland have tightened their regimes under pressure from other countries. To what extent are we seeing, either in response to the Panama Papers or the Paradise Papers or now the Pandora Papers, concerted effort by countries to rein this in, to get more clarity, more transparency on these issues, or creating, I guess, what you would call regimes to try to govern them? Have we seen any real sort of movement on that, or is it really just sort of one-offs? People put pressure on Switzerland or the Cayman Islands, and then the issue of the day passes and they move on?
Well, you're right. With each wave of these documentary revelations, political pressure ramps up and things do tend to happen. But this goes back a long way, Jim. We've had efforts to take action collectively against criminal illicit flows coming from criminal networks, for example, drug trafficking, going back to the establishment of the Financial Action Task Force in the 1980s. So this goes back a long way. I mean, you could say it goes back all the way to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the United States, which was an effort to stop bribery on the part of American corporations abroad. So the problem has been on the agenda, and what has driven it each time has been a new set of what are these predicate crimes. So originally it was kind of drug trafficking, the French connection, you know, that sort of thing, trying to get at that. Then post 9/11, a lot of attention to terrorism financing. And that was when a lot of things were tightened up under pressure from the United States government. And the corruption issue really arose on the agenda starting in the 1990s when corruption became a big development issue. And initially, the image a lot of people had of corruption, and especially the financial side of corruption and the transfer of funds abroad, was kleptocrats in developing countries, right?
Mobutu and Zaire is a classic example.
Yeah, Mobutu, you know, these prominent examples. What has changed is the realization is that these individuals, kleptocrats, could not move their money without the assistance of a great number of individuals and firms in the industrialized world. And that's sort of where we are today. How do we get at that problem that, as the president of Estonia just made a speech recently about this issue, that we, the North, benefit from these illicit flows, and we just don't like to admit it, and we could crack down if we wanted to. And we've had many examples of this. One of the big cases in Europe in recent years was Danske Bank. Well, Danske Bank was the biggest bank in Denmark, which is usually ranked as the least corrupt country in the world, or one of the least corrupt countries in the world. But the incentives for taking illicit financial flows, largely from Russia through a branch of Danske Bank, which was based in Estonia, were very, very high within the bank. I mean, do you ask questions when you're making lots of money from these flows? And sure enough, they didn't. And then the whistleblower brought the whole house of cards down. So steps have been taken. Most recently, the European Union has tried to plug gaps in its regulatory, partly because of the Danske Bank scandal. The feeling that national anti-money laundering was not strong enough, was not accomplishing what needed to be accomplished. So now the EU is setting up its own money laundering authority at the European level, which is a big step forward, in many ways tougher than what we have in the US. You have the United States Congress taking this year steps to require revelation of beneficial ownership, which is a big issue. Who actually owns these assets? That then can reveal whether they are, or help to reveal whether they are legal or illegal, certainly. And we have new legislation, and this gets to your point about the Pandora Papers. What is called the Enablers Act has been introduced, and it's important. Many of these are bipartisan, which in this contemporary period in the United States is very rare. The Enablers Act would require this whole army of trust companies, lawyers, art dealers, and others to apply the same principle of know your customer that banks have had to apply for a long time. So that gets at this beneficial ownership question, right? Do you really know where the money is coming from? And you must know that legally if this act were passed. And it would not just apply to banks now, it would apply to real estate companies. For example, one way that money is laundered very easily in the United States is through the real estate market. And that's true in London as well. So there are
been true of many capitals around the world. I've often heard that Panama City, which has a large number of high rises, that nobody lives in most of the apartment buildings. I don't know whether that's true or not. I've certainly heard it, but this is a major issue.
Correct. And in this country, Miami, New York, you know, there are certain places where it is easier to do this. As you say, it's kind of large condo markets and the money can easily be concealed in that way. And up to this point, not many questions were asked. If you came up to make a cash purchase in real estate in many parts of the world, it was one of the big areas of leakage around some of the measures that had already been taken to crack down on illicit financial flows.
Well, I certainly know on this score that there's, as you mentioned, action by the federal government. But as I read through the coverage of the Pandora Papers, one of the things it flagged is that the issue isn't federal regulation here in the United States, but rather state regulation. We've already talked about South Dakota,
right.
A number of other states also have regulatory regimes that are low on transparency, which makes them attractive for moving this money, whether it's for legitimate ethical reasons or for corrupt ones. How does the United States address a problem in which some states are pursuing policies that make it easy to create these essentially tax havens or to funnel money? I will note that, you know, according to the Tax Justice Network, the United States is the number two tax haven in the world, edged out only by the Cayman Islands.
Right.
And a lot of this is because of state regulation.
In part, I mean, tax haven means that those who are evading tax in other countries can shelter it in the United States. So that gets to this issue of they can move their money in a way that is not transparent. It cannot be tracked by tax authorities. And there is growing cooperation between the IRS and the United States and other tax authorities on this issue. But once again, some jurisdictions have different rules about secrecy that make it more difficult to get at that. The federalism issue in the United States, and I do not claim to be an expert on this point, but my sense is that most of these loopholes could be closed by federal action and legislation. So states can go a certain distance to make themselves into tax havens. But if they become havens for truly illicit activity, then it seems to me the federal government has instruments that it can take or use to shut these down, and already has done so in the case of truly illicit activities. Now, you know, the question of how do you govern trust companies, that typically lies at the state level. But once again, my reading of at least some of what has come out since this revelation about South Dakota and also other states, as you mentioned, is that there are loopholes in the federal tax law that allow South Dakota to take advantage of this loophole, and individuals even more to take advantage of this loophole using the trust company set up in South Dakota. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see with these sorts of revelations whether there'll be a rollback of some of this at the state level. Certainly, I think, though, for the truly illicit activities, as opposed to simply tax avoidance, which is not illegal, it seems to me the federal government has the instruments to take care of it if they choose to do so.
Miles, I want to go back to the macro level and just consider the question of how significant this issue is among all the other issues out there in the international political economy. I certainly understand why the release of something like the Panama Papers grabs a lot of attention. Indeed, it led, I think, Steven Soderbergh to make a movie.
Yes, he did.
On
a
the
good
topic.
Movie, actually, yes.
The Laundromat. It had,
yes,
among other people, Meryl Streep, and it was,
yes,
quite good.
Yes.
And so I understand why this makes for sort of the grist for political debate and concern. And I understand why people want to know how many homes King Abdullah has and whether they're in Malibu or elsewhere. That sort of fits into our sort of fascination with the wealthy and the rest. But how significant is this problem of money being parked abroad, global cash flows that are perhaps not just unethical, but illegal? And again, we're not saying that any of the individuals mentioned here broke any laws.
Correct.
We neither of us are lawyers. But just sort of help us think through, what is the significance of this issue? I mean, if you're going to go into the Oval Office and talk to Joe Biden, you know, do you say, Mr. President, this is an important issue, or this is something that you let the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury deal with?
Well, it has been elevated actually by the Biden administration. There is an actual presidential attention to this issue of corruption. And what we're talking about here is the system that enables corruption. As I mentioned, originally the system that was set up internationally was not directed at corruption. It was directed at other sorts of predicate crimes like drug trafficking, money laundering that resulted from drug trafficking, other criminal enterprises, and especially terrorism. Criminal enterprises we'll leave aside. The terrorist side, in terms of volume, we presume is relatively small, tiny compared to these sorts of flows. So we're really talking about the corruption, tax evasion, tax avoidance set of issues. And here, it is a big problem. It's a big issue for a number of reasons. First of all, it undermines our faith in democracy. One of the fundamental principles of a democracy is that the law applies to everyone equally. And what we see here is, and a sociologist at Dartmouth, Brooke Harrington, has made this point very well, is that the very wealthy decide which laws apply to them. They can law shop, if you will, to determine where the laws that suit them, that's where my financial assets will be. And this really undermines our sense of fairness about the political system, which is a major part of the rise of populist movements, certainly on left and right, a sense that the economic system is basically unfair. These financial offshore centers are not used by the middle class. They're not even used by the upper middle class. These are used by the wealthy. And that means that they have a way of perhaps completely legally lowering their tax burden that is not available to the rest of us. So there's a question of fairness here, quite apart from the question of fairness of what the tax burden should be, and that's a much bigger debate. So corruption really, especially when it's overt in countries, especially some of the East European countries I talked about, it really starts to undermine belief in democracy. You're talking about a country that has come out from communist rule like the Czech Republic, and it believes its leaders are dealing in a corrupt fashion, using their public office for private gain, that really undermines their faith in the system overall, and they may turn to other types of systems in the longer run. So I think it is a very important question. It potentially creates problems, and one of the reasons we're concerned about in the U.S., for the financial integrity of our own financial system, right? That the fact that there is so much potentially dirty money sloshing around in the system, it corrupts our financial system. Financial integrity is an important point. I mean, this is going to become an even bigger issue we won't want to get into today with the rise of cryptocurrencies, obviously, and the concern about how do we deal with, as we move into a more digital era, how do we balance this concern about privacy and the need to offset and deal with the issues of financial integrity? And that's a big dilemma and it's a big issue.
I mean, I think it's remarkably complicated, and that makes it difficult to get political traction because people get lost as to what they're talking about. In this situation, you know, we have instances of outright illegality, which I think everyone agrees should be confronted. But then you get into the gray shades. That is, when does using rules turn into the abuse of rules?
Right.
And I think people can have different takes on that. And that's, you know, the question that comes up just thinking simply domestically in the United States in terms of to what extent people are following or abusing exemptions in the tax code that allow them to pay a lower tax rate, right? And you get into those arguments, and oftentimes you end up in a protracted back and forth with the IRS, and maybe you get a ruling in your favor or not. But, you know, those are really sort of complicated, nitty-gritty issues as opposed to big picture, broad brush sort of decisions.
Well, we should also, and I think this is one of the reasons the U.S. is concerned as well, thinking about the rest of the world, for many developing countries, especially those that rely on natural resource extraction, oil, natural resources of various kinds, this kind of corruption has real implications for their development. I mean, it's not going to affect the economic trajectory of the United States, the underlying economy of the United States probably, but for smaller developing countries, even relatively large developing countries, this can have a macro impact on their development prospects. I mean, the corruption is not staying inside the country and being reinvested. It's being taken offshore and used for private purposes. And that is a big, big problem for some of these countries. And you have countries that should be rich that are still poor in per capita terms because the natural resources have not been used to the benefit of the society as a whole.
Any closing thoughts on this overall issue of corruption, Miles, that we should think about as we part?
Well, as you mentioned, Jim, it's a complex issue. It's complex partly because these financial flows and these financial centers are what they are because they are secret, which makes it very difficult to even determine what's going on, which is why these document revelations are so important in a sense. But I think we also have to think about what is needed on the other side. Do we need more resources in the Department of Justice? Do we need more resources at the international level? As I mentioned, the EU has set up an anti-money laundering authority to oversee its financial system. We certainly need to support the non-governmental organizations in developing countries that are working on transparency issues there. We need to support journalists, and not just those that have revealed these documents. Journalists in general, the media play an important role in enforcing transparency where individuals do not want transparency enforced. So there is another network, a political network out there that we should support, quite apart from whatever action we should take as a government or in our foreign policy, that is in many ways opposed to the network we've been talking about, which enables these questionable, in some cases, illicit financial flows.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Miles Kaler, Senior Fellow for Global Governance at the Council and Distinguished Professor at American University School of International Service. Miles, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thanks as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. And today's episode is dedicated to Zoe's cat, Pandora. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.